since we are now beginning the story of David and Bathsheba, it's important that you remember a few things about this story. Okay? Because there is a reason why Israel is at war. This story doesn't just kind of just happen at a certain time. Okay? What has happened up to this point is that prior to, although there was a united monarchy under Saul, the people in Israel, which is the what you and I now know as the northern kingdom is Israel, the southern kingdom is Judah, okay? The people in the northern kingdom had not gotten the memo. And so they were more allied in small confederacies that decided, depending on who the leader was, whether they were going to follow his leadership or not. Okay? And so David is kind of rising to the throne, and he has sent a letter, he sent an offer of a treaty to the people in the northern kingdom, basically inviting them to come under their rule, okay? Which basically was, why don't you guys come and join us, and if not, we'll come to war against you, okay? And the people rejected David's leadership. So before he even kind of gets in power, there's this pushback from the Ammonites. And what we discover is that they have rejected David's treaty, offer of treaty, and that's why he is going to then have to send Uriah as the commander of a group of his army to go and fight the Ammonites. Okay, the point I'm trying to make is this didn't just, oh, this is just an event in David's life. This is a response to a political problem.
Yeah. The Ammonites were not of the northern kingdom. They were, I mean, they were probably allied with a few along their borders.
Right.
But they were not.
They're 20 miles to the west.
But they're okay. Not to everyone.
No, no. They're, yeah. You're correct.
Yeah.
You're correct. And that's why I'm saying that it was like a little confederacy or a kind of subgroup. Okay, that's 20 miles west of, there's a wadi that comes in and feeds the Jordan River, and the Ammonites were like there.
Yeah, so he's not fighting his own family.
No, he's not. But they have said, thank you, but no thank you. That's not okay with David, because David understands, remember, he had served under Saul. He got to watch the political intrigue. He heard about all of these treaties that were attempts to get certain tribes or people to come under his rule. Okay? David felt, I believe that the text will support, that Saul's weakness was not in demanding allegiance. He followed Abraham's model of leadership, which is, God told you to drive them out, drive the Canaanites out of the land of Israel, but they weren't that bad. And some of our people intermarried with them, and, you know, we don't have to drive all of them out, you know. Saul kind of followed that same tactic, okay? And that is, I'm not going to demand leadership, or demand you submit to my leadership. But David, as David rises in power, he is going to. So this story starts out at a time when David is kind of trying to assert his authority. And in asserting his authority over a political foe, he has, shall we say, a momentary ethical conundrum. Okay? Let's understand, okay, that if you live in Israel, even if you are wealthy, which Bathsheba's husband would have been wealthy, okay, as a commander over people, they don't have long wood. They don't have, like, trees to make big beams and all this sort of stuff. So even luxurious palaces all had little rooms. Forget open concept living. Okay, they didn't have it back then because they didn't have trees long enough to span. So even if you go in small houses, okay, where you might have a room that's 10 by 12, you're going to have a beam in the center of it. Okay? So the more affluent you were, the more likelihood that your house would be built around kind of a quadrangle. Okay? Because you don't need long wood, long beams to do that. Okay? Most people believe that's the kind of house that Uriah and Bathsheba lived in. It's the spring of the year. What does that mean? Not only is it time for the lambs to be birthed.
The annual bath.
The annual bath. Okay. Go ahead, Evelyn.
Well, the thing that always strikes me about this particular beginning is in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle.
Thank you.
I mean, that makes it sound like they battled every spring.
That's right. It was the season. It was like NFL football. Okay, it's spring. Why are we going
to
do this? Okay. A lot of times, biblically, okay, what you need to do is kind of erase your modern mind and start to think like ancient people. Okay? What happens in the spring?
Things dry up.
Babies are
procreation.
Let's shift to agriculture.
Baby. Plant stuff.
You have to plant stuff. And if you have to plant stuff, what happens to happen to the ground?
It has to be tilled.
Where are the men?
Tilling the soil.
The men are out tilling the soil. So if you're a king and you're going to go into battle, the greater likelihood that the military commander is going to be able to summon the men from the fields about zero. Because this is a desert climate. You have got to get things planted when they need to be planted or they're going to get scorched. Right? So the reason that kings would go out to battle in the spring is that would be the most difficult time for your enemy to gather soldiers. Okay? So what's happening? It's spring. They're going to do this. Okay? You can't think about the temple or the sacrificer. We don't have the temple yet. None of that. The tabernacle's out there. The Ark of the Covenant. We're going to have a whole lesson on the Ark of the Covenant next week. David and the Ark of the Covenant. But right now, the issue is they didn't respond to my offer. We need to teach them a lesson. We need to get men to go to battle. And if you are commissioned to battle, okay, there are a couple of things that you need to know. Number one, okay, apparently David didn't get the memo in 1 Samuel 21:4, but what would happen when you were getting ready to go to war is that the military officials would call the people together and they would be consecrated for battle. Once that occurred, sexual relations were forbidden. Okay? Now, there's a lot, if you happen to have ever known anybody who's a bodybuilder or a major sports athlete or somebody like that, where if they're not taking steroids, they refrain, you know, from sexual activity before the contest. Okay? There's long-standing physical and physiological proof that that is true. It is also a biblical command according to 1 Samuel 21:4. Okay? So when Uriah, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but when Uriah is going to be told by the king, come get drunk and maybe you'll go have relations with your wife, even drunk, Uriah knows this isn't something he's supposed to do. But I get ahead of myself. Okay, spring of the year, time when kings go out to battle. David sent Joab with his officers and all Israel with him, scouts, and they ravaged the Ammonites, besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. Typically, okay, if this was a major battle, David would have gone out with him, even if he was the ceremonial leader of the battle. He doesn't this time. It just so happened, late one afternoon, when David rose from his couch, was walking about on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman in the hot tub next door. The woman was very beautiful. David sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, this is Bathsheba. Okay, now, a couple of interesting things about her name. Nobody really knows what it means. You know, in so many biblical names, you can look and see what it means. Okay. In the Hebrew text, okay, her name does not have an H. She's simply the daughter of Sheba. Okay. Now, Sheba is not a person. It's a country. It's a country. Okay. So, was there a woman who was named after the country, like Phoenix or Austin, or, you know, how people name kids after towns or areas? We don't know. But the best guess of what her name means is daughter of Sheba, and is that after another person who's named that? Is this person from another country? Is she not Israelite? We don't know. Just a lot of times, you know, pieces and their little clues. We don't really know about this other than that. She is a 10 on the Boderic scale. David sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, this is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, wife of Uriah the Hittite. She's taken. Okay? Now, that she's married to a man who's a Hittite only increases the likelihood that this woman is not an Israelite. We know David is because he was born in Bethlehem. We're not real sure about his wife. And it could be that at this time there was a lot of intermarriage that previously had been condemned and people are just kind of not paying attention. David sent messengers to get her. She came to him. He lay with her. Now she was purifying herself after her period. And are going, what? Okay. Curious little thing. Do you see where it says he saw from the roof a woman bathing? The woman was bathing. Okay. The word that's used there in Hebrew is the bath that the woman takes to make herself ceremonially clean after she has her period. Okay, so this is like a ritual washing. It wasn't, she was out sitting lounging on the hot tub. Okay, this was her religious obligation, and therefore it then assumes maybe she was an Israelite. Although the Israelites weren't the only people to be ritually purified after a woman had her period. And what do we know about this? Okay. She ain't pregnant now. And she's fixing to be pretty fertile. Okay. Then she returned to her house. The woman, when she returned to her house, excuse me, verse 4. Then she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I'm pregnant. Now, you notice there's something that's just kind of glossed over.
Time.
Well, time. But also a phrase, her consent, we don't know. Again, that would have not been uncommon for a woman to be forcibly raped, okay? But the other, you know, there's nowhere in the text where it says, and David went into her, and they had relations, and she got pregnant, okay?
4B.
Well, that's what 4A means, doesn't it? Yeah.
He lay with her.
It's implied.
It's implied.
He's not asleep.
I'm sorry?
It's implied.
Yeah.
I'm not making a big, huge deal. We know what happened. They weren't watching TV. Right? Woman conceived, she sent, told David, I'm pregnant. Okay. Bathsheba, being the wife of a ranking military officer, is going to have lots of servants. There are going to be lots of servants to send messengers back and forth. She's not going to tell him herself. David goes, ruh-roh. Y'all didn't get my Scooby-Doo humor there. Anyway, David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. Okay, Uriah is Bathsheba's husband. Okay, he has been doing what? He's been off fighting the Ammonites. He hadn't been around. You know the old joke, the first kid can come at any time. After that, they all take 9 months. Okay, people would be counting. Okay? David knows that if people start counting, unless the baby's incredibly premature, somebody's going to be looking for the...
Her servants
know. Okay? David said to Uriah, go down to your house... and wash your feet. Now, don't believe me. Go look up, Google, washing your feet, or feet in Hebrew. The word feet, plural, is the same word that's used in Hebrew for men's genitals. Okay? So if you go back to the Noah story in Genesis, when he came in and he says, and he saw his dad's feet, it wasn't looking at his toes. Yes. Okay? It's a euphemism. Okay? So when David says to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet, what he's really saying is, you've been out in battle for a long time. you know, I have noticed you're married to an incredibly beautiful woman. You know, I'm sure you've missed her. I'm sure that you have missed having relations with her. Go wash your feet. He's not talking about these. Okay? Uriah went out of the king's house. There followed him a present from the king. Well, of course. What's David trying to do? Butter him up. Probably sent significant libations. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, the servants as well as the military people, and did not go down to his house. When they told David Uriah didn't go down to his house, David said, "You've just come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your house?" Okay. David doesn't care where he sleeps. David cares with whom he sleeps. And he doesn't want him sleeping with his soldiers. He wants him quickly to go in and see Bathsheba. Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah remain in tents." See, the temple hasn't been built. Okay, there's a thing later in the story where David is going to get this great idea, you know, I built this beautiful palace for me, and God's living in a tent, why don't I build a house for him? Okay? God didn't want David to build the house. He does allow him to buy the land that Solomon's going to build the temple on. But we don't have any temple right now. In this particular case, okay, when we look at this kind of fact dropping, it's coming out of Uriah's mouth and not David's. "The ark and Israel and Judah remain in tents and booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As you live and as your souls live, I will not do such a thing." He'd read 1 Samuel 21. Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. On the next day, David invited him to go get drunk. Eat and drink in the king's presence, made him drunk. In the evening he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of the Lord, but he did not go down to his house. Okay. Something that would have been very common in the ancient world for people of power, just like you have today designated drivers, okay? People of power in the ancient world often had people who were assigned to keep them, shall we say, ethically pure. Okay? There were people often assigned in the courts, in the kind of courtier of the king, to be his food taster, to make sure he wasn't being poisoned. He would have his armor bearer. He would have kind of a security, kind of valet kind of person. But then he would have kind of like an advisor. Think of like the campaign advisors. Okay, you know, we have to maintain the king's reputation at all times. Very probable that he had someone like that. Uriah, that is not David. We know David didn't, or he wouldn't have gone over to invite Bathsheba. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, sent it by the hand of Uriah. Okay? Uriah's carrying his own death papers. Okay? Because what this letter is going to say is, I want you to put Uriah on the front line of the battle. And when the battle is hot and heavy and fierce against the Ammonites, I want you to withdraw the soldiers. Okay, I just want to point something out. What starts out as a complicit act between two consenting adults, theoretically consenting, although she could have been raped.
Or heavily persuaded.
Yes. I.e., you don't sleep with me, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
Very.
Or husband loses commission. And
it could have been a host of things. Okay, whatever the case may be. The issue, though, here that I want to make sure we don't lose as we're trying to unpack the story is what starts out as an incident between two people, the circle grows. More and more people know about it, think about it, hear about it, are witness to where Uriah is and isn't going, where David is and isn't going. And as time goes on, instead of remedying this situation, it gets worse. More and more people are brought in. Joab, as the messenger, is bringing word back and forth to David, and lo and behold, he brings back the word, and the clincher is in verse 21, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead too. Whew. David can breathe. Because now, Bathsheba, though she may be mourning, she's pregnant, she doesn't have a husband, she's going to be looking for somebody to take care of her. David is going to, if you'll pardon the pun, rise to the occasion. So the messenger went, came and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, the men gained an advantage over us, were pursuing hot and heavily, came out against us in the field. We drove them back to the entrance of the gate. The archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead. Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Didn't we just hear that? David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one, now another. Press your attack on the city and overthrow it and encourage him. There's a little piece of this puzzle that I want you to make sure everybody realizes. Jerusalem is not the capital of Israel at this time.
Okay. Jerusalem is not the
capital of Israel at this time. Shiloh is where the one of the temples is, where the Ark of the Covenant has been kept. But Jerusalem is not a major player at this point. Okay. When the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. When the mourning was over, David sent, brought her to his house. She became his wife, bore him a son. Isn't that a blessing? End of story. Let's move on to the pursuits of the king. Oh, he had a dalliance with one of the officers' wives. She got pregnant. He's taken care of her, you know. I mean, you can just imagine this is a Clinton gloss over. But what's happening, okay, and this is very common in the Old Testament, that while they're telling you a story, they're basically driving home a bigger point. Truth isn't hidden.
I'm sorry?
Truth is not hidden. David thinks he got away with it. He did not. Now, it's time for God to act. The thing that David had done displeased the Lord, and the Lord sent Nathan, who is a prophet, someone who speaks for God, to David. He came to him, said to him, and he tells him this basic story. there was a man who came to the city, and he only had one little ewe lamb. But there was another man in the city who had lots of lambs. And the man who had lots of lambs came, and he took the one from the man who only had one lamb. You know, we almost think, is this like Jesus telling a parable or something? No. No. What Nathan is doing is he's laying out in typical Hebrew fashion. Remember, the king is also the judge. Remember, they had had judges rule them before this. We said, we don't want any more judges, but we still need somebody to do that. Now you're going to be the king, but you're still the judge. Okay? So Nathan is just laying out this very innocuous story, because what he's wanting to do is not point a finger at the king yet. He wants the king to rule, make a ruling that will be binding. And once the ruling is made that's binding, that the judge has made, judge king has made, it can't be retracted. As then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. He shall restore the lamb fourfold." Curiously, the Greek version of the Old Testament says sevenfold. But this is following a different tradition. It's fourfold. Because basically what he's done is he's stolen. So the judge is basically ruling on this, saying this is a matter of restitution. This is what needs to happen.
He's just done essentially what Uriah did. He's just spoken his own death sentence.
He has. He totally has. Uriah carried his death warrant. David is speaking his.
And what keeps going through my mind now is the old saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, every one of us here can name at least four political leaders who got into the same mess for the same reason. And, I mean, what's different about this?
Gee, there's not anything different. What's the old saying about...
The more things change, the more they stay.
No, absolute power corrupts, and power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
None
you know,
of those women would start the bloodline of Jesus, though.
This,
sorry?
Yeah. I mean, this is one point that we can't forget in this story, and that is Bathsheba is going to be the mother of Solomon, who is the descendant of Christ.
Ancestor
of Christ. Okay? So if we're kind of doing our, you know, scarlet thread of redemption, it's coming through Bathsheba. Okay? So we know, I mean, we should know that nothing bad is going to happen to her. She's going to be protected. Where the finger's going to get pointed here in just a minute is at David. Because he has now made this rule, he has now made the judgment, okay? And look at what he is charged with. He shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. Because he had no pity. She's pretty, I want her, she's mine, I take her. Doesn't matter about Uriah, doesn't matter what she wants. I want her, she's mine, I got her. I'm the king. Okay? Nathan says, in the most trembling of voices, because I can just imagine he thinks, I'm going to say these words and somebody's going to stick a sword through me.
Yeah.
Okay? David says, or Nathan says to David, you are the man. You are the man. And then compounds it. Whenever you see the word, thus saith the Lord, and you'll see this more in the written prophets, like Isaiah and Ezekiel and people like that, they'll start out and they'll say, "Thus saith the Lord," or "Thus saith the Lord who reigns from on high," or "Thus says he from the high and lofty place," "Thus saith the Lord." It's kind of your parentheses. They're called the prophetic parentheses. Okay? And when he does that, okay, he's saying, "David, this isn't my opinion. I didn't just dream this up. I didn't learn this from anybody else. God has sent me," and notice the pun, "to be judge over you. I came to you to be the judge over this situation. Now God has sent me to be judge over you. I anointed you king over Israel. I rescued you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house, your master's wives into your bosom." Okay, let me clarify that, because the rest of the text in 1 Samuel is not clear. Okay, but when Saul died, all of Saul's wives, concubines, property, everything is shifted to David. Okay? The text doesn't make a big deal about them, but that would have been the laws and rules of the time. "Gave you the house of Israel and of Judah. If that had been too little, I would have added as much more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord?" Take things, matters into your own hand. "Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You've struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You've taken his wife to be your wife. You've killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, for you have despised me and taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife." I want to tell you a very interesting story. In the ancient world, after Jesus, after we get the time of the written Gospels, we have a whole series of people who were the early church fathers. I'm sure you've heard people talk about them, the pre-Nicene fathers. These are the kind of masters of faith and theology until we started getting councils to make decisions. And oftentimes what would happen is these people would take an Old Testament story, because remember, the New Testament isn't seen as scripture yet. They would take an Old Testament story and they would bring it to a particular New Testament story and say, "Now let me tell you what this really means. This text from 2 Samuel was required to be read on 2 days in that kind of post-apostolic period. And the first time it had to be read was on days commemorating the birth of Christ and the story that's told in the Gospels when Simeon and Anna come, you know, they present Jesus at the temple and they hear the prophecy to Mary that a sword will pierce your soul. So they tied this story of Nathan's prophecy about the sword, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house," verse 10, they tied it to this day, and they also, this was the first reading that took place on Good Friday. The consequence of sin
is death.
Okay? Very, very interesting. "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, for you have despised me. You've taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife." You see, David never kind of stood up and said, "I'm going to rebel against God and go have an affair with Bathsheba. But Nathan wants to be clear from God's perspective that that's where it began. You rebelled against me. I set you to be king over Israel. I sent you to be judge. I gave you the moral gifts and the wisdom to exercise this, and you went and have done this. Thus says the Lord, I will raise up trouble against you from within your own house. I will take your wives before your eyes, give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this very son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. Curiously, just in case you don't know the rest of the story, four of David's sons are killed. And Absalom is typically credited for defiling his mother. Discredited for defiling his mother. Okay? So I just want you. Absalom.
Yeah, I know Absalom, right?
Yeah.
Defiling
his.
Bathsheba was not Absalom's mother.
No, she's not his mother. But there is a text that talks about him sleeping with her. We'll get to it. Trust me. David's wives and concubines are violated by Absalom. Okay, now, to David's credit, we all have to applaud him. Once he realized he was caught, he confessed. Okay? I know we're not used to seeing that. Okay? David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Nathan said to David, now the Lord has put away your sin. You shall not die. Nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord, the child that is born to you shall die. Nathan goes home. One of the things I want you to realize about this story that so oftentimes in our modern world of cheap grace, there is a sin, you forgive, let's move on. There are no consequences. There are regularly consequences of sin, even after forgiveness is given, that live on. Let me give you an example. In the early days of the AIDS scare, there were people that I knew who came to me as a priest to deal with matters of infidelity. And I said to them, the game has changed. No longer do you go get a shot and you're cured. Now, because in those days we didn't know what the incubation period of AIDS was, I said, you need to be mindful that this one act, and it was one act in this particular situation, where this one act of indiscretion, okay, you need to now protect your spouse and your children from the effects of this incredible disease. And they wanted to have other children, and no, now you can't have other children because you can't have unprotected sex, and we don't know what's going on, and all of this stuff. The incredibly painful part of this story that I'm going to tell you is that the man did die from AIDS, and I buried him. And I went to his wife after we were through all the craziness. And she said, thank you so much for protecting me and my children. And she said, you know, I continue to be tested. I'm AIDS free. But she said, had you not said that, we might be telling a different tale. She forgave him. They continued to live together. They were married. I don't know exactly what the extent of their physical relationship was, but in his death, she lovingly cared for him. But there were consequences. Okay? A lot of times people say, oh, you have to forgive and forget. Well, that's true, but sometimes there are consequences. Sometimes there's restitution that has to be paid. Okay? In this particular thing, David did do the honorable thing. He did confess. Nathan forgave him on behalf of the Lord, but the child that Bathsheba conceived. Now remember, David has another wife. Remember Michal? Mm-hmm. Saul's daughter? Okay? I mean, you know, at this time, apparently monogamy was not a strong influence in Israel. But the Bathsheba story, okay, is a story of adultery, murder, God stepping in to bring about a resolution, confession, absolution, consequences. Okay? Yeah.
So God's purpose with David was stronger than David's dereliction.
Without question. Without question. And why can I say that? Because God continued to use David long after this event in a very mighty and powerful way. Virtually all the Psalms were written after this. There are times when David, I mean, if you're assuming David wrote all the Psalms, we can look at some of those Psalms of lament and just, you know, there's something about, to borrow a few lines from my sermon this morning, weakness. David had to not only identify his weakness, not run from it. You know, he could have said, well, all the kings do it. Well, that doesn't make it right. Okay? That doesn't mean God's going to redeem it. In this situation, David is going to look back on the affair with Bathsheba, and he's going to view it very differently, especially at the end of his life, and we're not going to get to that till August, okay? But we have to remember that Bathsheba becomes the mother of Solomon, who's the ancestor of Christ. Okay? So obviously, he still had loving thoughts to her at least once. Okay? We're going to have to break at this point. You can go on and read, David repents, even though they plead with God to spare him. David is going to get up. Yeah.
Quick question.
Sure.
Solomon's journey is so far. She warned the king named Solomon, the Lord was going to send a message by the prophet Nathan. So he named him Jedediah.
No, no.
What did he name him? Solomon?
Yes. Okay. Favored of the Lord. They're not ever going to call him that. They're going to call him Solomon. But they're not going to call him Jedediah. Okay. Yeah. It's just like there are times when even after Jesus says to Peter, you shall no longer be called Kephas. You shall no longer be called Peter. You shall be called the Rock. And he goes back and calls him Simon. You know, so would be known by both. But Jedediah, he's never referred to as.